Okay, I trust you, Richard.
You're not dealing with chimps here.
Throw things at me.
But I do think sex is the superior alternative. we could have the audience vote.
No voting.
Come on. All right. Come on, Greg.
No, my poor innocent ears.
this panel is the writer's spirit, and we'll get into what that means or doesn't mean in a moment. Well, first, let's have some introductions.
All right. My name is Gregory Wilson. I am an associate professor of English at St. John's University in New York City. It's my day job. But my other job, more recent job, is that I'm an author. My first novel came out in June from Five Star, The Third Sign, which is a work of epic fantasy, and has gotten a very good response here in particular, which is wonderful. And the other hat that I wear is that I'm co-editing an anthology on speculative fiction and politics with a number of people, including Hugo nominee John Helfers, who is here as well. That's the other thing I'm doing in addition to other novels which are currently out on submission. So,
my name is Elizabeth Vaughn, and if you've been to any of these panels, you know that I write romantic fantasy or fantasy romance, and I am only found on the romance shelves in the bookstores. And yes, I think sex adds to every story. At least romance does, definitely. So I currently have 5 books out, a trilogy called The Chronicle of the Warlands. The first book is War Prize. And I have 2 standalones, Dagger Star, White Star, and the next one in the series is Destiny Star, and it'll be released in April of next year.
Okay. I'm Richard Lee Byers. I write fantasy and horror. In recent years, I've done a string of Forgotten Realms novels that some of you may have read. This panel is the writer's spirit, and you know, when I was first noticed I was moderating, I thought I was pretty much okay with it, because I was the writer's spirit, and I thought it would be kind of the Scott Fitzgerald panel, where we would talk about what it is that we get liquored up on, what we choose to get liquored up on before we sit down to write.
Right.
Then I looked again, though, and I saw there's actually, like, the writer's spirit is in, you know, the writer's soul, and then I was not sure why I was moderating, because writing crushed my soul.
Honestly.
But be that it may, that is what this panel is about. It's you know, why do we write? What do we get out of it? What are we trying to get out of it? Mm-hmm. And hopefully, without becoming too sappy or new agey about it, we can explore some of that stuff. So, why do you guys write?
Honest to God, Richard, I should have brought Kleenex. I write because it's the closest I'll ever come to actually wielding magic. Okay, done, go.
I'll tell a quick little anecdote. The reason that I remember Beth is that this was exactly her reaction after she had been published in 2005. I was like, I think she cried a little bit, and she was very, and I was exactly the same thing.
Very emotional.
But it was, but it's wonderful. I think we have, I was at WorldCon last week, and I was listening to someone talk about how easy it is as authors to make everything about ironic distance and everything about cynicism, and everything is about how, you know, you think that that person's good, but they're not really. And you think this, but it's all, nothing is, everything is shades of gray. And honestly, of course it's true that complexity is important, moral complexity is important, but honestly, the reason that we write, sappy as it may sound, is because it allows us to communicate. I always think that the reason I write in fantasy, the reason any of us pay attention to fantasy, we live our realistic lives in the hope of accomplishing what we have imagined in our fantasies. And so, for me, writing fantasy speaks to what is best in us and what could be best in us. And that's why I write, and I don't give a damn if that's not cynical enough. That's why I think I should write. So, that's why I do it.
There's kind of a joy that I find in imagining these, sort of intense or miraculous situations. I mean, there's 2 levels to the enjoyment for me. One is the enjoyment of the story. You know, I want to find out how it comes out the same way that the readers do. You know, I want to experience the moment when the dragon rises up over the mountaintop or whatever, the same as the readers do. And writing stuff like that actually allows me to experience it even more vividly than reading somebody else's story, even though that story might be a lot better than mine. I mean, it takes me into the experience more deeply. That's one level of satisfaction. another level of satisfaction is I really do enjoy playing with the words. I mean, I really like, you know, tinkering with a sentence and looking at it and saying, no, that sentence doesn't suck anymore.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, this actually says something with vividness and economy, and I can put the comma in the right place. I mean, that's another level. So I guess a third is about the communication, where you actually become aware that somebody. Read it and liked it. And it was touched. I just did a panel across the hall here, the previous panel, and then I was making my run to the restroom between panels. And coming back, and a guy saw my name and grabbed me and told me he liked my stuff. You know,
never gets old.
Never.
Yep.
You know, there is definitely there's the private aspect and the public aspect. The public aspect is people saying, "I love your stuff. I enjoy your stories. Your stories or your characters touched me." But there's the private aspect when you're home in the shower, scrubbing your hair, and you go, "Aha! I can do this! It'll make everyone crazy!" And it's that moment of creativity when something comes together in a story, or you think of an idea, or that perfect little bit of dialogue comes along.
Yep.
There is no better feeling in the world.
I agree. I remember a few years ago sitting watching Cirque du Soleil, which I dearly love. And it was, I don't remember which odd Varakai, Zuzuzu, I don't remember the heck the names of them are, the titles. But, and it involved these small little creatures were running around the stage while this angelic creature was doing these, fantastic trapeze things. You guys know the Cirque du Soleil stuff, right? Overhead. And I was immediately struck with this idea of what would happen if this winged creature fell and met these small little creatures. Where would they be falling into? Where would the creature be falling into? Why would the creature have fallen in there in the first place? And I started imagining this thing in my head, and it ended up being my second novel, which is called Icarus, about a young boy with wings who falls into the heart of a dormant volcano and the creatures that he encounters there, told from his perspective and one of those creatures' perspectives in alternating chapters. And it was exactly that kind of thing where I was kind of like the... wow, and then I just kept thinking, and then my poor wife on the way home, I was like, and then I could do this, and then I could do this, like, yes, you know, because she's heard me do this before. But that moment, that private moment, is really a spectacular one, because it is a moment of absolute creation. And if you've ever had the experience of doing art or playing, composing music, or involved in dance, choreographing a dance on stage, or writing, that moment when you all of a sudden have this revelation that will appear on the page, and then on the public side, when people get it or see it and think, wow, that was really... that's wild. You will never find anything better than that. You get chills thinking about it because it is that special.
Finishing a manuscript and getting it done is very, very addictive. That moment when you actually have it all printed out and there's nothing left to do and it's time to turn it in, and I'm usually weeping as I'm stuffing it in the box to send it to my editor.
No, really?
Really, because it's like, all this work. Oh my God, I did it again. Ooh, can I do it one more time? I bet you I could. Yeah. And it's a very addictive thing. Writing is even if I wasn't published, because you can lose a contract tomorrow. The editors can pull the plugs at any time. The publishers can go out of business. I would still write. Mm-hmm. I would still write. It might be more of a private thing. You know, I might resort to the internet, but I would still write because it's just part of me at this point.
Yeah. One of the interesting... looked at with pleasurable moments, you know. This is one that I always like, and I don't know how creepy, but as I'm kind of blundering my way through a story, you know, and I reach a point where I really don't know what should happen next, or I don't know how the characters are going to get out of trouble or whatever. I tend to write kind of a broad outline. I know what's going to happen, but I don't know how necessarily. I often find that I'm stuck in chapter 9. I kind of reflect back on what I brought sure. It's in chapter 3 I did this, and what I did in chapter 3 leads to the solution of this issue I have in chapter 9. I think, damn, there's like somebody inside me a lot smarter than me. I just think that's a cool moment.
Thank God, Past Greg did that.
It's almost like I know what I'm doing.
Or you're writing along in a trilogy, and in the third book, book, you go, man, I really like to do this, but I don't know what I did in book one. And you go back and you look and you go, I am a genius. Yeah. I was just vague enough in one that I could pull it off in three.
And since you spend half your time thinking to yourself, I am a moron, it helps when you have those few moments. I'm a genius, you know, because you need those to compensate.
To absolutely balance out.
Yeah.
I was going to say, with one of the things that absolutely fascinates me with the whole writing process is it's almost like it's a conscious and unconscious thing at the same time, you know, like, especially like when you're in the zone, it's like, oh, this is so cool, and it comes out, and then you go back, and sometimes you don't catch it on the first reading, but you'll catch it maybe on the third or fourth, and you'll see little hints of the way things connect with each other, mm-hmm. and when like, you're like, wow, that is so cool, you know?
When it flows... It's fabulous. Mm-hmm. And when it doesn't, it is agony.
Yeah.
And a lot of people can't get past the agony,
But you have to get to the good stuff.
And that's part of the contradictory thing about creative writing, mm-hmm. is you have to put up with the pain in order to achieve the pleasure to a certain extent. I suspect it's a lot like raising kids, but I wouldn't know.
My 18-month-old agrees. Yeah.
That's true. Man, you're writing and you have a small child?
I wrote a lot of it before she was born.
Yeah, okay.
But her birth in an odd way was sort of confirmation, I think, for me of what I had been doing in my writing, in that, that is the most joyful moment of creation, you know, beyond my writing or anything else, is this beautiful, you know, this beautiful child who is running around, wearing a shirt that's of a character in this book, by the way. but that moment for me was almost a sort of confirmation that you can have a normal, wonderful family life that is partly expressed through the work you do. The example that I like to give in another context is, how many people have read King Lear? Or seeing King Lear, okay. When you read or see King Lear when you're younger, before you have children, you have one reaction. When you read or see King Lear afterwards, you have an entirely different one. If you read The Winter's Tale, and you read about Perdita, who is Leontes' daughter, who is supposedly lost and then is found, you have an entirely different reaction to that after you have children than before. And as writers, I think you are responsible, we are responsible in part, for producing work that people will be able to relate to in different ways, ways that we wouldn't have expected them to, and which will be rich enough that as they return to it at different stages in life, they will connect with different portions of the book. And the best books, I think, the best work in our field or any other field, allows you to access it on different levels. And it is even a little unconscious while you're writing it, but it's definitely there. I feel a richness in my writing now, even more than I would have felt before, because in part of the birth of my daughter.
You know, I had the same reaction to Gone with the Wind. When I saw it as a kid, I was like, oh, Melanie, she's so sweet, she's so nice. Damn, Scarlett. When I saw it was older, I'm like, oh, God, Melanie.
Yeah.
Get a backbone. Go, Scarlett, go!
It's true.
So it really is a totally different perception of the same material.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's true.
We know how that is.
Yeah. All right. Well, one thing that occurred to me as I was preparing for this, preparing is a strong word. But as I was
doing a broad outline,
thinking is how I might possibly stumble through Bodrigan's panel was, it's very easy to come in here and we could gas at you for an hour about the exaltation of the creative process. And how swell it all is, and how swell we are for being able to do it, and that kind of thing. But I mean, most of you are, I would assume many of you are aspiring writers, right?
Some of you?
If you're an aspiring writer, hold your hand.
Okay. Notice they didn't want to say anything before.
It's a shameful
person.
Thing. Maybe we kind of talk about the flip side of the coin. You know, what are the things that, you know, if you're pursuing writing seriously and professionally, what are the things that you're going to encounter that are really going to test your soul, test your spirit? And what tips can we give these people for dealing with some of that stuff?
Time is one thing.
Yeah.
Time is one thing you will have less of. And it involves, there is a sacrifice that is associated with writing, and you can't minimize that. A lot of people ask me about, you know, what stage of the process, and they give me these pithy things about, you know, well, the goal is as important as the journey is as important as the goal, and, you know, it's all about that. I have to be honest with you, the journey is not my favorite part of this. It is the goal, because I'll tell you, when you are on, you know, the 80,000th word, right, of a 110,000 word novel, and it's late at night, and the screen is kind of bathing your face in white glow, and you've been looking at the same goddamn sentence for the last 20 minutes. Like, how do I? That is not a joyous, you know, yeah, the bicycler going up the mountain. You know, that's not the part that I like. And those moments will test you, because those are times when you could be asleep, or if it's during the day, there could be time spent with family. It could be time spent completely vegging out and playing a game or doing nothing at all. All of that time is time which often, if you become a real writer who's serious about it, goes to your writing. It doesn't mean that you have to give up your life entirely, as I said before about my daughter, but it means that you need to prioritize and balance your time wisely, and you need to be aware that you will have less of it that is your own. You can't become a writer, even if you have the so-called day job. You cannot become a writer and do it halfway if you want to be serious about it. You can't be like, ah, you know, I'll kind of do it occasionally, and maybe if I get a chance. If you get a chance and that's the way you're approaching it, you're not going to be one. I'm sorry. There are too many good writers who are committed to their craft for you as the kind of dilettantish, you know, I'll see what I can do when I get a chance, when I get some time. You're never going to have the time unless you actually budget it out of your day. So there is a sacrifice of time associated with it, and that's not as much fun. It's worth it. It's well worth it. But when you're in the middle of it, it can be trying. There's no question about it.
And family members and friends and colleagues will say, well, yes, I know you have a book due, but you have to take a break sometime. My personal favorite is, you have to eat sometime. Let's go out to dinner. And I'm like, you don't understand. It takes 20 minutes to get to the restaurant, 20 minutes to get seated, an hour to sit and talk to you, and 20 minutes to get home. And frankly, that's time I need. You know, it isn't just the meal itself.
Right.
And as much as I love you dearly, I'm under a deadline. Yeah. And they do not mean to sabotage, but they do.
Yeah.
And you have to make choices. I myself gave up television almost completely. It's a joke among my friends, because they've got these big, lovely TVs. They're huge. And I go to their homes and go, ooh. And they go, you watch less than 20 minutes of TV a week. And I go, yeah, I know. But still, they're so pretty. And I've got this little TV. But that's a personal choice I made. I do not watch television. I come home. I eat dinner. I pet my cats. I feed them. And after that, they just don't care. And I sit down and I write, usually between 7 and 10 at night. And if I'm on deadline, I get up at 4 and I write until it's time to go to work. And I usually try to be work at 8:30. And those are choices that I made. But it requires, you know, a degree of sacrifice. Now, when I got my first contract, it took me 3 years to write my first book. And then I had 9 months to write the second one. And talk about utter panic. And my agent said to me, how frequently can you produce for us? Because at that point, as Anton Strout once told me, I am a fat, juicy milk cow. And they want to know how many gallons I will produce in a year.
Of course Anton said that.
Yes, of course Anton said that. He'll deny it, but
yes,
it's true.
Of course he did.
And I told my agents and my editor at the time, a book a year. I can do a book a year. And that's what I've done. Since 2005, I've had a book a year released. I now have 5 books out, finishing up 6, going to start 7. Yes, that comes with a price. Now, do I still socialize? Yes, of course. I have 2 gaming groups I've been in for almost 20 years. And they will not. They would physically come and drag me out of the house. And I've got family, and I try to see them on a regular basis. But they know that at a certain point, I'm going to say, you know, I need to go in the bedroom. I need to shut the door. I need to get out my laptop. Love y'all. See you in the morning. And I'm going to go write. Because the other thing I've discovered is, my books are usually due June 1 to the editor. And she usually takes roughly 30 days to get back to me to tell me, oh, it's lovely, except, you know, revisions.
Right.
So for that 30 days, I'm on vacation. I'm on my writing vacation. I watch DVDs. I read all the fantasy I can get my hands on. It is very hard to get back into my writing routine. It is hard, and every year it seems to get a little harder because, you know, NCIS on DVD is like crack cocaine. But I have to get there or I will not meet the next deadline, which is June 1 of next year, you know? So it does come at a cost sometimes. And sometimes you say to the family member, okay, we'll do this, but then maybe the next day, I stay up late and write what I need to get done in order to meet those deadlines.
Yep.
I have to adjust to them
yep.
because not only do I want to become an antisocial person, but and I want them to love me, but also because human interaction is necessary in order to be a writer. You know?
Yeah.
You can't just lock yourself in a room and expect to produce. You have to have that kind of human interaction to be creative.
Even Lovecraft had pen pals.
Even Lovecraft had pen pals. And Mom was upstairs.
That's right.
So, you know.
That's right. Nor would I want to completely abandon public interaction, or I wouldn't get to do stuff like this, which I enjoy. I love
exactly.
coming to conventions. I love speaking
because
to people who've read the work.
Nothing better than talking about writing.
Yeah.
Definitely. So much easier than writing itself.
Definitely.
Now, you write full time.
I do write full time, and I mean, and that comes with its own. I still do write full time, but now I do another thing too. Writing full time comes with its own set of problems, which is you do have more free time. I mean, it's like, you know, yeah, I've pretty much seen about as much TV as I wanted to see.
Yeah.
You know, I can tell you about every rotten episode of Smallville. the show that, because I'm a bit lifelong comics fan, I don't seem to be able to stop watching no matter how hard it sucks. But that's another topic. If you are doing it full time and you don't have another job, it can be a very precarious financial position, and you have to be able to live with that that level of uncertainty until I was making it for a number of years, certainly not getting rich, but actually making it just on my writing. And then the end of last year, I had to have cataract surgery, and because I was self-employed person, I had shitty self-employed person's insurance, which was all I could afford. But cataract surgery is not an emergency thing. Fortunately, I'd saved up money. You know, I said, all right, my lame-ass insurance is going to pay this much. I've got all this. I've got this money saved up. I can handle it. Well, the surgery on the left eye went south. There were problems, and I had to have a third, much more expensive operation that I had not budgeted for, to clean up what had gone wrong in the left eye. That operation went fine. I'm fine now, but I went up with serious debt, and so then it became an issue. Well, how long do I really want this hanging over my head? I've now taken an online teaching job to make the money to pay off those bills fairly quickly. By the end of next year, I hope to be out from under. But of course, if the whole writing thing goes south, then that becomes the money that I live on. that's going to be back right there. Now that I'm doing it, I've kind of decided, after living with that level of anxiety for all those years, it's like, what's the next. What's the next contract? What is the next royalty statement going to look like? All that kind of stuff. I'm probably going to keep this gig even after I have the bills paid off, because I decided that I seem to have reached a point in my life where it's easier for me to tolerate having less free time and being more tired often than the money anxiety.
I think
we've defined the choice.
Yeah.
The choice is to, the choice is to have your day job, and therefore be able, give up a lot of the time that you would otherwise devote to things that you normally enjoy or whatever, and put all the discipline into that's required, and be tired as you often will be. Or, like I said, if you're lucky enough to where you even can make it just on writing, which is a position a lot of people never reach, you're just going to have to tolerate a very high level of uncertainty about your finances. Unless you become a superstar, then it's all good.
There aren't that many Dan Browns.
Yes.
So and that's another reality of the writing world that you need to understand. When young people in college say to me, ooh, I want to be a published author, what would you recommend? And I usually say, get a day job. get a day job, and then write, you know, on your off hours, and build up a writing career over time. And eventually, you might get to the point where the writing income is dependable enough that you can quit your day job, but it will take time.
Yeah, and patience is one of the most important virtues that needs to be developed. This business takes a long time. It takes a long time to break into it. It takes a long time when you're in it for things to come back to you. When you submit, I always laugh when people talk about, you know, so how's your new book? I'm like, my new book? I wrote this thing, took me years and years to think of it, then write it, then, you know, what was 2-3 years with my publisher. You know, I mean, this business takes a while. And it takes a while to sort of build up a kind of momentum. And momentum is a big thing in this business because, as you were saying, you start producing books, people expect more books, then the income starts to come in, and then it becomes more dependable. So getting to the point where you've built enough momentum for that to happen requires a great deal of patience. I do want to throw out the caveat so we don't frighten everybody off, that, you know, part of what you will adjust based upon the circumstances you need to adjust to, by which I mean when you're in the process of writing and you have all of these other time commitments. In my case, the birth of my daughter required me to reshift my priorities, right? Because I am not one of those people who's going to be like, you know, well, the hell with it. Honey, you take care of her. I've got to write because it's in the name of my art. And that's garbage. You know, she also needs a father. And it's important to me to be as committed to her and committed to my family as it is to my writing. So what does that mean? Well, it didn't mean that I gave up anything. What it meant is that I had to become, first of all, more disciplined as a writer. It meant that when I had time to write, I really needed to do it. That meant no surfing the internet. That meant no going and well, all I have to do, oh, I'll just come, you know, watch this one episode. So I was forced to become more disciplined as a writer, and I did become more disciplined. That helped a lot. Because the more disciplined you become, and the more experienced you become, the easier, I think you guys would both agree, the easier it becomes to produce work and work that you really think is good work as time goes on, because you have practiced it, because you become better at it, because you build a routine that works for you. So I don't think any of us are saying that as you proceed in your writing career, you will eventually, you know, become this, you know, wizened old person thinking, I was a miserable person, but I have 400 great books. And that's not the way most authors function. The way that most authors function is they figure out ways, they balance off responsibilities and time, and they're able to figure out a way to do it. It sometimes requires a little more fatigue. It requires, you know, making different choices, but they're choices that you can realistically make. And so I don't want people to be too frightened about it. I mean, it does require sacrifice. It's not a bagatelle. You do need to commit to it, but that doesn't mean that you were abandoning your life. In fact, if you did abandon your life, in my opinion, you would become a worse writer. Yeah. You would instantaneously become a worse writer at the point when you sort of disconnect from the rest of society. Yeah. You can't possibly write well if you don't know what actual human beings about whom you will write in your work in some capacity, even if they're fantastic creatures modeled on human beings. You can't write well unless you know about the people around you. And to do that, you need to be connected to them. So this doesn't mean either write or live. You know, you are able to do both. Yeah. It's a matter of balancing.
Yeah. Write, live, and eat. Well, okay.
Well,
write,
you know.
Write, live, yes.
Yeah. Eat on the fly.
Building on what you said about patience and building on some of the negative aspects, I'm going to mention, like I always try to do, there are people who will take advantage of you because of your dreams and ambitions.
Yep.
And there are two websites, Writer Beware and Predator and Editor. You have to be aware that there are people who will try to get money from you, and while you think they're helping you pursue your goals or dreams. The number one rule that I want you to keep in mind is money flows to the author, not away. Yeah. Anybody tells you there's a reading fee, anybody tells you that they'll recommend a freelance editor for X number of dollars is probably a scam artist. There's enough information on the internet that you can avoid these people. It recently happened to somebody in my romance writers group where they got an email from an agent saying, you know, I'd love for you to submit something. I forget what she'd done. She might have entered a contest, because contests are big in the romance genre. And, you know, please, inviting her to submit to her. And she was all really excited. And then she checked, I think it was Writer's Beware. And it was a scam.
Yeah.
And thanks to the work of CIFWA, a lot of these people do end up spending jail time and get criminal charges because of what they've done. But in the meantime, they've got your money, and you can't get it back. So, money flows to the author, not away. And always double check the name of somebody. Always do your research and make sure that you're dealing with a legitimate professional.
That's an important point also about relating back to the topic of the panel about spirit, because, you know, part of the spirit of what we do is providing our creations to someone else. That is what we, if you like, paid them, right? Beyond that, we don't, it is offensive in the extreme to suggest that you pay someone else to publish the work that you worked over to produce. No. This is the work. This is the money, if you will. This is your product that you were giving them. And in return for that, this work that you worked on and slaved over and, you know, refined until it was polished and really ready to go, in return for that, they pay you for the right to read your work. I am very passionate about this because I have seen friends myself who have fallen prey to this stuff, and it is heartbreaking. These people, these vanity presses in particular, prey on the fears that you all have that I'm not going to get published and no one will ever hear what I have to say. These people are despicable, and deserve whatever bad things are happening to them. Because what they do is they peddle people's dreams, and it's wrong.
Now,
and so,
having said that,
you need to avoid those people, and Writer Beware and Predator and Editor is a good example.
We are not tarring small presses. You know,
no, but those are not vanity presses. This is a small press.
Yeah, small presses are fine. Yep. There are lots of legitimate avenues for you to get your work out.
Right.
And absolutely, I would encourage you to pursue all avenues. But the key here is educate yourself. Make sure you understand what you're getting into. And once again, money flows to, not away. Yes, ma'am. It's Editors and Predators and Writer Beware are the two that I remember offhand.
And the spelling of Predators is, you know, Preditors, as in Editors and Predators. Yeah, it's a little weird. Mm-hmm. But that's very good, and Writer Beware is also excellent. Victoria Strauss is one of the people who runs that.
Yes.
Is also, if you send her an email directly about someone you're not sure about, she'll get back to you normally in a couple of weeks. Victoria is a very, very hardworking, underappreciated, really, fantasy and science fiction writer, actually.
Yep.
But this is a big part of her career now, and Writer Beware is a very valuable resource. Yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
Well, writing weird creatures helps. Like, I don't know any Arlings. It's not me. It's these people.
You know, earlier I was saying, before we even started the panel, in my day job, I have an incredibly thick skin. People can say all kinds of rude things. I've been spat on. And well, a couple death threats, but it was a while ago. And it doesn't bother me. Because I know that they're looking at a human representation of an evil. They're not really seeing me. And it doesn't, you know, okay, whatever. On the other hand, as an author, I have an incredibly thin skin, even after 5 books. I can't read reviews. I can't even read positive reviews. I do not surf the web for reviews. I don't go to Amazon and look. I can't, because even a good review has the capacity to shut me down completely. But for oddly enough, I've never had a problem giving my writers group my stuff, giving my agents and my editors, on a professional level, the criticism will be constructive and it will be appropriate to the situation. Reader reviews on Amazon, I do know of one, which shut me down for a while. The woman gave me 1 star and she said, "I hate this book, it really sucks. It's in first person, I hate first person." And I'm like, how did you not know? You open it up and you see, I. And that just shut me down. So again, that there's that whole thin skin thing. Now, if you're doing something besides fiction, you know, in fiction you think you're exposing yourself, but I have a friend who deliberately reads my stuff to see if he can see me or our mutual friends, and so far he hasn't been able to find anybody. And I'm just as glad. What you think might be exposed is not really there for other eyes to see.
I mean, I think that obviously, you know, your personality and your values and your beliefs are going to, are going to pervade your work, and you want them to, because I mean, because if they don't, why should anybody read you as opposed to all
right.
the other stuff they could read?
That's right.
You have something unique to contribute, and it's you.
Yeah.
And but I mean, I don't think that by and large, I mean, you expose things about yourself in a bad way. You know, I mean, I don't think that somebody's going to read your fantasy novel and say, you know, bed letter. You know, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not, It's not like handing him your MSCI profile, yeah. You know? I mean, it
would they just send an email with that one line? Bedwetter, oh, yeah. Damn it. Found me.
It doesn't provide that window into who you are. I mean, normally, I mean, even if you write about something that, even if you write about a childhood trauma or something like that, I mean, only people who already know you and know about that trauma are really going to say, oh, you know, she must have been mauled by a zebra as a child. You know, she herself. You know, I think that the one thing that could, in theory, happen, you know, is, I mean, if you take people that you know and you transcribe them in a very, very obvious way, the thing, you know, they may recognize themselves. This happened to Truman Capote, right? That's kind of how his career ended.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he wrote about sort of, you know, Manhattan High Society and all these very recognizable things. I don't remember the name of the work anymore.
It's like an
unfinished novel,
yep.
Right? The first part was published in Esquire or something.
You're right, it destroyed his career.
And all these people immediately shut him out, yep. and it destroyed him. I mean, yeah, so, I mean, that happened, you know, and that could happen. I mean, if you're writing fantastic fiction, you know, that it's probably somewhat less likely to happen. You know, your gaming buddy, you know. The guy in the next cubicle is, you know, probably not going to realize that he's the Martian Cyclops, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, that's one thing. I think the ultimate answer is you really can't sweat it. You know, I mean, you've got to tell the stories that are in you to tell in the most dramatically effective way you can.
Yep. And the best work that you're going to do is work that allows people some kind of access into the characters that you've provided. By which I mean, if you're producing a character that is so personal, and if people ever found out it was you, right, would be so personally painful to you, it's probably not a great character. An example that I sometimes give is I worked years ago on a magazine, and there was an article submitted. It was a literary journal, and there was a story submitted about this sort of almost short vignette. And it was about this guy on a beach, and I saw the man on the beach, and then I knew everything had changed. And I was like, what? You know, and I'm looking for other pages, and I'm like, did I miss something? And I said, well, what is this about? And she's like, well, I really can't talk more about it. It's too personal. And I was like, well, but this is a... People will read this. Well, that's why I have to be very careful about what it is that I say. Can you write this in your journal and give me something that I can give to them? You know, and the truth was that was so personal, so private, so, you know, having only meaning to, you know, the writer, you know, him or herself, that there was no way it was going to be a character that anybody else could relate to. Most authors have a combination of both what they are, as Richard said, this is the part of you that you're revealing, and what the readers can see in themselves. In fact, you might often have the opposite issue, where people will come up to you and say, oh yeah, I totally saw where you were talking about me with this character. That's me, right? You know, that's happened to me a couple of times. I also play in a band, and one of the songs we wrote is a song called Bipolar. And I had a relative of mine come after, you know, I didn't know you were going to write one about, you know, because I had that, I was bipolar, so that's about me, right? I was like, and what do you say? He was very pleased that I had written. Yeah. So I was kind of like, it's about many people with the condition you describe. I'm glad that you were moved by it. And he's like, that's great. And you didn't even hear what I said. He's like, hey, he wrote a song about me. And, you know. So people, readers will come up to you sometimes and say that they thought, or, you know, friends of yours will say they thought they saw this or that in your book. But it will, generally, they won't be upset about it. And generally, they're not right. You weren't thinking about them. So the best characters are a combination of what you provide and then what the reader brings to the story, too. So.
Yeah. If you know a bipolar person that's going to read your stuff and think he sees himself as important to see if you can arrange for him to read it while he's on the ups.
he was medicated by this time.
Do we have other questions? Nick.
Do you think writer's groups are useful, I guess?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. The right kind of writer's group.
And that's the key, isn't it?
Yeah, define that for me.
Well, In my case, I have two. One is sort of on hiatus, and the other one which I'm currently in. The one that is on hiatus is one through some of my colleagues at my university, who were able to put up with my academic and then my non-academic stuff. You know, they're giving me the, what is this? It's a fantasy book. All right, Greg. They were very helpful in part because they're very educated, smart people, but don't necessarily write in fantasy. And that was very valuable for me because they were able to talk about things that as sort of generally literate but non-genre readers, they can talk about things that might have caught them short. And since I'm always in my work trying to not just speak to fantasy people, but other people who might like just good literature, I would hope, that's a very useful thing for me to have. The other group is an online group called Codex, which is for sort of speculative fiction authors in the early stages of their career. And so those are, and later on, those people have become, you know, bigger as careers progress. Mary Robinette Cole, who won the Campbell Award last year, Tony Pye and Aliette de Baudard, who were nominated for it this year, Tobias Buckell, you may know, those are people who are in Codex, and so they're all professionals at my same stage, so that when I'm able to give them information, I don't feel, I mean, it would be really weird for me if I was somehow in a writing group with George Martin. I mean, right? I would send something to him, what if he doesn't like and he says, this is terrible, you know, then my career is ended because George Martin says, yeah, I'm terrible, right?
It's not the kind of blurb you want.
Not, yeah. So this is an example of someone who is a professional, who knows the business, who is trying to progress, and who is a good writer because you need to have sold a few things to get into Codex in the first place. But they also understand the process, and therefore they won't. I'm not saying that George Martin would crush you, by the way. I'm just using it as an example. But you know, they will not. You know, they will know. You know, to be constructively critical in the process of doing it. And those writer groups are valuable not just to keep your work flowing, because you need to produce work for them to see, and they'll bother you if you don't have work that they've seen. It's also valuable because it gets you out of that solitary shell. Which even if you do your best to do what we said and try to have a life as well, there is a solitariness about writing, and the more you can have people saying, you can have sort of a wall to bounce ideas off of and say, is this okay? And they can say, yeah, I would do this and this, but I really like where this is going. That's extraordinarily valuable. So finding a writer's group that is the best balance of support and criticism is, I think, the way to do it. And you can find those both online and then around you. Sometimes your local libraries or universities will have resources where they know where to find some of these writing groups.
But be cautious, because there are dream crushers out there, people who will take, you know, whether they realize it or not, great pleasure in trying to crush you down for trying to pursue something that is a dream of yours.
Often when their dreams were crushed first,
yes,
by the way.
And run away. So, yeah. I mean, I can't tell you, you can't get away from those kinds of people fast enough. And the way you tell is, it's got to be constructive criticism. It has to be constructive.
I want to give like a slight flip side to this. I mean, many people, I mean, you know, what you'll generally hear is that good writers groups are good and bad writers groups are bad. But if you find a good one, great for you. And go with it. And that could very well turn out to be true for you. But there are certain individuals who will not benefit from even a good writer's group, because everybody's creative process is different.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's like, and I'm one of those people, so I know whereof I speak. It's like, when I'm working on a story, you know, I just need to, you know, be alone in my room and sulk with it till I get it together. You know, I mean, even good criticism from savvy people doesn't really help me. Mm-hmm. It just puts me off. You know, and it just puts me off and makes it harder for me to work. And then the point of what I'm saying is that, you know, if you try out what you pretty well can see is in fact a good writer's group, and you don't like it, it's not working for you, you know it's okay to realize, oh, I'm one of those people that shouldn't be in a writer's group.
Yep.
I mean, and get the hell out. I mean, if you have every reason to think that in objective terms it is a very good group, if it's not working for you, don't be there.
Yeah, which you could probably apply to any, you know, of the advice that we gave you. I think that's important.
Absolutely. You know, the creative process is a very individual process. And why you come to these seminars is you're listening to how other people do it, and then you pick and choose. But anybody who tells you you must write a novel this way is already wrong, because your process is going to be completely different. In an earlier panel, Anton Strout said, well, I just sort of write, you know, I write here, and then I write here, and then I write here, and then I sort of tie it all together like Frankenstein's monster. I'm looking at him like, how in God's name did you get three books done?
Yeah.
Because for me, that process would not work. I would not be able to function that way. So, you know, pick and choose, listen to what we say, ignore what you want to, and take away what you, what works for you. And feel free, you know, sometimes writing processes change between books. Sometimes I want to be sitting at a computer and actually, you know, typing it all in. And sometimes I want to be in my big red leather chair with my pad of paper and my pen writing. And you've got to find what works for you, what allows that creativity to flow onto the page.
One of the things, too, that you'll find is the balance between confidence and humility, by which I mean you need to be confident enough in your own work so that if someone says, I hate first person, or something like that, that you can, you know, to the extent possible, not let it derail you entirely from your own writing. And this will apply even on a professional level, where editors will make suggestions. And I'm going to get to the humility side in a minute, but from the confidence side, there are times when you'll say, no, I hear what you're saying, but I really think I want to go this way. Because ultimately, your name is on the book, and you're responsible for the work that you produce. And these other people are a big part of, you know, the editors, the agents, whatever. They're a big part of assisting you, but you are the one who drives that engine. The flip side of that, though, is the humility side. And that is to say, and that's where the writers group can sometimes come in, you do have to have your ears open at seminars like this, listening to authors, talking with people who have written. You need to have your ears open because there is a certain kind of panel participant or people who come to panels. And I know because I was sitting exactly where you guys are sitting 4 years ago when I sold my book to the editor who was speaking on one of these panels. And there's a group of people who will kind of say, yeah, that's really interesting what you were saying, but you know what I was thinking was, and then they'll go off on this big long thing, and you'll find out later on that they've never published anything, they've never produced anything, they've never really written anything, because they really, either they're afraid of change, or they don't like what they hear, or they're so sensitive, the thin skin thing, that they can't, you know, accept any criticism. The problem is you're not likely to progress as a writer if you're not willing to accept constructive criticism of your own work.
Yeah.
And these people really do know what they're doing.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you have to adopt their individual process, but when they give you advice, like, you need to revise, you need to, you know, you need to stick to be disciplined, you need to, you know, think about the story, you need to construct the story for various circumstances. When they're giving you this advice, you need to take it into account because they have been published, because they have been doing this, because they are experienced. So balancing confidence in your talent and your work and humility when other people give you suggestions on how you can make it better, that's the dance that I think all of us need to do as writers.
Well said.
Thank you.
Question, I think. You've been speaking about needing a real-world job and situations like that. It seems like some of my best conversations or some of the best thought processes that pop out seem to be either in that half an hour to an hour on the way to work or the way to the soccer game. But when you finally get time to write it down, it doesn't feel anywhere near the same. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that frustration? Do you have any...
Absolutely. I always have paper and pen with me somewhere. And just in that moment, I can almost guarantee every time, just before they say, "I'll rise," some character says something in my head, and I'm like, "Shit." And I write. And I write it down. I'm zoop, 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 zoop. Meanwhile, I'm standing up. But as soon as I can, I get it down, and then I stuff it in my purse or in my pockets or in my briefcase or wherever I can. And then at the end of the day, I pull them out, and I go, ah, genius. And I'm going, what was I thinking with this one?
Right, right, right.
Because if you don't get it down somehow, the damn thing goes away, and you lose it. And during the day, when we're dealing with that rote stuff, that because we've done our jobs for a while, that part of our brain's over here going, why, yes, Your Honor. And the other part of my brain's going, I think they should have sex before the battle.
Just don't confuse those parts of your brain, though. It's really...
Okay, true story. I'm going to take 2 seconds. What I used to do is we have, in court, we have cattle calls, which is everybody shows up at 1:30 and then your cases are heard in order. So you're left sitting there for an hour and a half and you're the last one on the docket. Anyway, I would take a legal pad, I would fold up the first couple pages, and I'd be sitting there writing. And I was before I was published, I could get away with this. Now I cannot. But I was sitting there writing, and one attorney who was about to present his case, as he sits down, he leans over and he goes, "Why are you taking notes about my case?" And I'm like, in the middle of a sex scene, and I just went, "I'm not." Now, however, everyone knows what I'm doing, including the judge, and I can no longer get away with it. But at the time, I was brilliant in those brief little moments. But you have to write it down. And that means, for some people, it's carrying one of those little pocket recorders. For me, it's having paper in the car and half-wet legal pads in the bathroom and paper in my purse at all times, because you never know when that's going to hit or strike. But then, at night, when it's time to sit down and pull it all together, you need to bring out all those little pieces of paper and start getting it organized into some semblance of, yeah, of work.
My experience is slightly different as we talk about actually kind of getting the specific line of dialogue. My experience is that when I actually go to write it, almost never, that line of dialogue almost never works exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because when I go to structure the whole scene, it just doesn't flow to that pithy little exchange of lines.
Right.
But I still think it's really valuable as you're going about your day when that stuff is just coming to you, and it's like you hear the characters talking, because that's when you know you're really into it, and that, which is where you want to be. So I guess what I would say to you is, you know, if it doesn't seem the same, it doesn't seem like it really fits, you know, don't worry about it. Just monkey with it. It still shows you're doing something right that came to you in the first place.
Right, and when it came to you, it means your brain's functioning to do what it should, which is giving you these ideas. In my case, as a university professor, you know, if I'm teaching a class and this comes to me, I can often, you know, so one of the things we need to think about is, consider that for just a moment while you're writing in your notebooks. I don't do that much, but you know, it is helpful to be able to have those. And for me, having not a 9-to-5 job, but a job which requires huge bursts of energy and then sort of downtime, which is what the life of a university professor is very helpful, because it gives me those moments during which I can sort of cogitate and think about in between prepping for classes and all that other stuff, but I don't have to be constantly, you know, 8 hours a day on alert. I'm kind of, you know, I have these sort of moments where I'm in class and then I'm out and I can think between them. So sometimes what you're choosing to do as your day job, if you have that option, can help as well. And there are other people for whom having a 9-to-5 job gives them a routine which they can then structure writing around. So it's different for every person as well.
Yeah. I was
going to
say, I think we've done our 50. So I guess the moral of our panel is write and have sex, not necessarily in that order. Thank you for coming, however you react.
Thanks.
Thank you. Oh, and if you have
tickets, please bring them up.
Yeah.